Welcome to this discussion, debate, on one of the most important issues of the day, namely, who's going to win the White House next week. We've given it the title, It's Foreign Policy Stupid, on the pretty obvious grounds that foreign policy is central to what this election is primarily, but not only, about. And it's part of the contribution that the LSE, I think, is strategically extraordinarily well placed to make as part of a responsible debate about still the most important country in the world. And I'm delighted to welcome here this evening, on my right, Jamie Dumas from upstate New York, who attended Cornell University. He moved to the UK in 1998, running a consultancy in Cambridge, before returning to do postgraduate work at the University of St. Andrews. His principal area of research is the relationship between terrorism and public opinion, examining issues such as the dynamic of hostage taking and how counterterrorism efforts can decrease mobilization, recruitment, and financial support for groups engaged in political violence. Mr. Dumas is also chair of Democrats Abroad in the UK and the elected member, and I love this position, of the Democratic National Committee representing Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. Geographically, not too specifically, but we think we know what he's about. Jamie will speak first for 20 minutes, obviously representing the Democratic position, to then be followed to my left by Michael Scott Carter, who was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, and who studied theology and anthropology at Andrews University in Berrien Springs, Michigan. Whilst in university, Michael worked for a children's charity and with the local Republican office. And after university, he went back to Chicago and ran a charity for children and young adults amidst working with the Republican governor, George H. Ryan, as a consultant. Michael is currently studying law at the University of Buckingham and in his final year. Erstwhile, he's in the process, the notes tell me here, of applying for a PhD at Oxford University. I don't know why he's going so low. LSE is much, much better. But anyway... He's in the process of applying for a PhD at Oxford in government to start autumn next year. His future plans are to continue running his marketing, PR, and media design company while studying. We welcome you here, Michael, to represent the Republican position. However, for the first 20 minutes, I'll hand you over to my good friend, Jamie, to kick off proceedings. Jamie.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for coming tonight. Michael and I think I can speak for both of us, are looking forward to enjoying the interaction we'll have with you tonight. It has been amazing for the last 2 years to be involved with this election. And for those of you who are British and can't believe that an election would last for 2 years, I fully understand where you come from now. For those of you who are Americans, you understand that elections last for 4 years. But being over here involved for the last 2 years, it's been incredible. It's been inspiring. The interest that Americans living abroad are taking in this election and the interest that Brits, French, the Irish, and the rest of the world are taking in the election. Can you hear me on this? Okay. This election has been very much about, in many cases, George Bush and a lot of his failings. But even if the Republican Party had been, in my mind, smart enough to decide that they needed a new candidate, one who did not make a mockery of his compassionate conservatism, his fiscal responsibility, his strong but humble promises of leadership, I would still be standing before you today proud to be supporting John Kerry, because I think that John Kerry represents the best of what America has to offer. And in focusing tonight on foreign policy, I will gladly make the argument that John Kerry, as president, would bring us to a new age for the United States and improve so much that I think even those of you who aren't Americans should rush to any state that will take your residency at this late date and vote for John Kerry. And if you're going to Chicago or Illinois, vote early, vote often, and vote for all your dead relatives. Let me start by talking to those two of you in the room who don't know a lot about John Kerry. To give you a quick little bit of background, he is like George Bush in many ways. They were both born from privilege. John Kerry and George Bush both went to Yale. They joined some small secret society there that I think had more to do with fraternity life. But after that, they take some diverging paths. You've probably heard that John Kerry went to Vietnam, that he served for two tours, was awarded three Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star with a Combat V, and a Silver Star, before coming home to criticize and become one of the most vocal opponents from the moderate middle of the Vietnam War. After that, he went on to be a prosecutor, lieutenant governor in Massachusetts, and then began a 20-year career in the Senate, a career that I will gladly also defend for his records in terms of his service on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, his active involvement with helping to repair the wounds between the United States and Vietnam, looking into Agent Orange problems, settling the POW-MIA issue, and helping across the aisle with Senator John McCain to reestablish diplomatic relations with Vietnam. He was also involved in many other things, and I'll talk about those as they are appropriate tonight, including a very strong environmental record that I'll highlight in a minute. But there is a conventional wisdom in American politics that says you're an idiot if you run a senator for president. And this election has shown in good measure why that is sometimes the case. You see, over 20 years, John Kerry has over 6,000 votes that the Republicans get to make fun of. And so I want to talk to you a little bit more about how to put things into context to understand who John Kerry is by looking at some of the ways the Republicans have attacked those 6,000-plus votes. For example, you may have heard that John Kerry, the most liberal senator in the United States, according to the president and not many other people, has voted 350 times to raise your taxes. Let me change that for a second. We're only going to count that as 98 times. You see, the Republicans first attacked John Kerry for having 350 votes on tax bills. He will raise your taxes, the advertisement said. The embarrassing thing was many of those 350 votes were actually votes to decrease taxes. And when the paper started pointing this out, President Bush changed his attacks. So we went from 350 of the 6,000-plus votes were votes for tax bills to 98 votes were votes for tax bills. Now, if you're still paying attention to the numbers, President Bush repeated over and over again in the last debate that Senator Kerry would raise your taxes. He voted 98 times for taxes. As factcheck.org, which is different than factcheck.com, the website that some of you may remember Vice President Cheney sent everyone to, which unfortunately redirected people to George Soros. If you are looking for some good information, unbiased information from a wealthy person who's benefited from this administration, I strongly suggest you go to the conservative George Soros to see what he would say about the election. But if you go to factcheck.org and you check on first the 350 tax claim, then check on the 98 tax claim, we see some more interesting numbers. So of those 6,000 votes we want to criticize him for, 98 are now tax votes. But as factcheck.org points out, over 40 of those 98 weren't votes that would actually raise your taxes. Of the remaining 50-plus votes, most of them are votes for the same bills. For example, in one case, President Clinton's Deficit Reduction Act of 1993, Senator Kerry, as a senator, had to vote on that bill 16 times. Some of you will remember that not a single Republican vote had passed that legislation, which started us into the 1990s boom with the shrinking deficit, the growing surpluses, and generally good fiscal responsibility. But 16 votes by Senator Kerry get counted towards that 98 total for that. My other favorite, though, is Senator John McCain, a Republican, put forward a piece of legislation to raise taxes on cigarettes, something that's not the most controversial of American taxes. Now, to get to 98, President Bush wants you to count six different procedural votes that Senator Kerry passed on Senator McCain's tax bill on cigarettes. If you look at many of the other attacks on John Kerry, you will find that it is the same thing repeated over and over again. They attack him for voting for and against the authorization spending money for $87 million for Iraq without pointing out to you that the vote for the money was a vote for the money with an amendment to pay for that $87 million, and the vote against was a vote against the $87 million if we weren't going to pay for it, with speech at the time that clearly indicated, I know this is going to pass, but I need to send a message that this is the wrong way to go about it. But of course, they just want you to think that he's a flip-flopper. They also like to charge that he is the most liberal of senators, looking at a few-month period from last year in which, if you include votes to decrease the deficit as liberal votes, a definition I'm glad to take as a liberal, you might end up with Senator Kerry as the most liberal senator. Of course, if you look at his 20-year record, you find out that he's someplace around 25th for the sitting Democrats, making him a pretty moderate Democratic senator. They similarly will attack his defense cuts. They take a bill where he voted against an omnibus budget bill, pretended that by voting against that, it would have cut the entire military, cherry-pick a bunch of different weapons authorization programs and say he voted against this long list of weapons authorization programs. They don't want you to know that Vice President Cheney suggested we get rid of many of the same programs. Furthermore, we can take just as a final example of the type of attacks that we've seen against Senator Kerry, the most recent one, an advertisement that I like to call puppy dogs, but the Bush administration wants us to call wolves or wolf pack. If you want to go and take a look at the ad, it shows a series of wolves dangerously coming out of the forest and talks about how liberals and Senator Kerry don't understand the threat and that these wolves, who actually start looking pretty cute, are out there to get you. And they talk about how he voted after the first terrorist attacks in New York City. After the first terrorist attacks in New York City, he actually voted or proposed that we slash intelligence spending. How dangerous this man is. They forget to tell us that those first terrorist attacks were the 1993 World Trade Center bombings. That the money he voted to slash from the intelligence budget was because the NRO had been secreting aside money that they didn't spend on a satellite launch to build an extravagant new building. They don't tell you that Republican senators actually proposed cutting more, that the Republican bill actually passed, and perhaps worse, that Peter Goss, the new appointed director to be in charge of the CIA by George Bush, actually proposed larger cuts to the intelligence budget at the time, including cuts to cut our human resources capabilities by 4% each year. Things that they don't want you to know. But that's the type of attacks we deal with in this administration. So let's move on to talk a little bit about who John Kerry is, what he supports domestically and then internationally with foreign policy. I think that the debates in the United States did a wonderful thing for us. First of all, they showed that $200 or $150 million in negative attack advertising can be turned around when people get to see the truth. They showed us that Americans can be more comfortable with someone who is admittedly complex in his thinking and thoughtful and nuanced and international. They showed us that Senator Kerry could be more articulate, more thoughtful, more calm, and indeed, I believe, more presidential. I would not have faulted someone who did not know what Senator Kerry and President Bush looked like, thinking that the president in that debate or in any of those three debates was Senator Kerry. I think one of the reasons why people are so willing to support him when they get to see him is where he stands on policy issues. Before we spend most of our time talking about foreign policy, let's look at his domestic policy very quickly. There are four things I would highlight. The first one has gotten very little discussion so far in this election, but it's important, I think, to a lot of people, generally our age, that is between just born and probably in the 80s or 90s. And that would be the environment. This election, if the environment is an important issue to you, is an easy one. On one side, the League of Conservation Voters in the United States, a moderate environmental group, that has a long record of raiding Democrats and Republicans, congressmen, senators, presidents, is often seen the environment having traditionally been a nonpartisan issue. As much as we might despise him, Richard Nixon actually passed some of our best environmental legislation. We also had good legislation under George Bush's father, as well as many other Republicans. So the League of Conservation Voters, a moderate group, gives us a stark comparison between the two. Senator Kerry has one of their highest lifetime ratings. Of all of the people who put their name forward to run for president in this campaign, he had the highest rating, a very enthusiastic endorsement from the League of Conservation Voters. George Bush, on the other hand, maybe trying to think that he's supposed to live up to his previous grades, 2 years ago got a D-minus, if not their first D-minus ever. But more importantly, in their last rating of him, got the League of Conservation Voters first ever presidential F. It is not a tough campaign when you look at their environmental policies. Likewise, in health care, when George Bush came into office, 40 million Americans went without health insurance, something I think is just simply wrong. I don't understand why we can believe that public school education in the states, that state school education, should just be a right that everyone should have access to, but we don't think that children should have access to basic health insurance. I think that that's something that our country can afford to do and should change. Over George Bush's tenure, that 40 million figure did not decrease. It went up to 45 million. Over the last 2 years, somewhere around 82 million Americans have gone without health insurance for a significant period of time. The Economist magazine did a survey of economists 2 weeks ago. They found a number of surprising things, the Economist thought. One was that economists, by about 70%, preferred John Kerry. They specifically preferred his tax plans, and most specifically, they were highlighted the benefits of his health care plan as being a real, practical solution to bring down costs on small businesses, take away one of the large drains on our economy, help keep in check the cost of health care. The Economist wasn't looking to find that, but it was a great answer that they found. Likewise, in education, What should be the signature achievement of this presidency was his and on the domestic side was a bipartisan No Child Left Behind education, federal education program. The problem is, to get bipartisan approval, President Bush promised to fully fund it. We only left out $26 to $28 billion. Senator Kerry was the bipartisan support on this bill. Senator Kerry believes that we do need to try and make America's schools better, but he also supports that if we're going to do that, we need to give them the resources to succeed. And so he has proposed a national educational trust that any time the federal government passes a mandate on states and local school boards to improve their systems, that it needs to provide the funding necessary to do it. We used to hear a lot from Republicans about no unfunded mandates until they controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency. Finally, all of these domestic proposals would not be wise, in my mind, if they were not accompanied by fiscal responsibility. In one of these panels that we've done recently, they brought over the head of Deutsche Bank from the United States, thinking he'd offer a little bit of balance to the panel. And he talked about, well, the bond market probably first Kerry, the stock market might prefer Bush. But ultimately, I think that when it comes down to it, the more serious person when it's come to his evaluation of fiscal responsibility has been John Kerry. Because John Kerry has publicly said that he would cut back on his programs if the money wasn't there to fund them. He has made it a commitment that he would return to a pay-as-you-go style of spending to bring down the federal deficit. When we talk about the most liberal senator ever, they forget to mention that he was one of the first senators across the aisle and supported the Graham Rudman effort to decrease the federal deficit, that those 16 of the 98 tax votes were 16 votes on the 1993 deficit reduction package. That of those votes that made him the most liberal last year, a number of them were votes to decrease the deficit. That vote on $87 million for Iraq was a vote to pay for the $87 million and to be fiscally responsible as we move forward. But let's talk about foreign policy. I think in general, this is an easy choice when it comes to foreign policy between George Bush and Senator Kerry. For the first reason, we have 4 years of George Bush to look at. You could cast a die, and I don't think you could get much worse. But more importantly, Senator Kerry gives us 20 years of time on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee so that we can look at how he would lead and what he would do. We can take a look at what he has said over the last campaign and the way he looks forward as his approach to international relations. He was asked in one of the recent debates what he thinks about the preemptive war doctrine. I think his answer was enlightening. He said, all American presidents have always had the right to act preemptively. No American president ever has given up, and no American president ever would, and he wouldn't give up the right to act unilaterally and preemptively to defend America's interests if America is threatened. But, he said, and then he chose his words not so well, because he said, there's a global test we need to pass. And what he didn't mean was global as in the world, because he very clearly explained after that what he meant with the global test was Americans and the world community, other people looking at it, had to believe that you were right. I'm sure most of you have heard this anecdote too many times, but during the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we sent a representative to the president of France to say, we need you to be on our side, and they started to pull out the satellite pictures, and he said, no. The word of the American president is good enough. I would ask, if we had to go to war in the next 4 years, and we had to do it on the basis of satellite photographs or the interpretation of intelligence, how many world leaders could turn to their public and say, the word of the American president is still good enough? That, I think, is part of the problem. Senator Kerry has always talked about and continues to talk about the need for America to lead strong global alliances. That requires trust and respect for those alliances. That requires a good working relationship so that not only do those leaders want to work with you, but that their publics will support them when they work with you. Another gut check question. How many of you believe that Tony Blair would not get hung in the streets if 2 years from now President Bush said to him, we're going to war again, and he said to the British public, you have to trust us again, we're going to war again? Senator Kerry talks about an enlightened self-interest. I think the difference between the current Bush administration and George Bush surrounded himself with many smart people. It was a reason to vote for him for many moderates. There would be Colin Powell and Condi Rice and Dick Cheney, a broad spectrum of people. The problem is some of that spectrum has been silenced, and the rest of that spectrum has proven that their approach to the world is not enlightened self-interest. It's one that believes in zero-sum politics, that if we give up anything, that means that obviously it's been bad for us. When it comes to treaties, This government walks away, this administration walks away from any treaty because it doesn't believe that the world can come together and work on projects and make it better. I think a President Kerry would give us a new type of leadership, a progressive internationalism, instead of the destructive diplomacy we've had. Let's talk for a few minutes about Iraq. There are so many things I would like to say about Iraq, but let me just choose a few of them at random. I think the problem with the current administration is one of tunnel vision. We can admit no mistakes. We will hold no one accountable as long as they agree with us. And we will continue to go the course. Now, sometimes going the course is a good thing, but when you can't admit that things have gone wrong, when you can't take responsibility for the mistakes to show that we can lead better, you do not win hearts and minds, and you certainly do not win the problems on the ground. For example, Larry Lindsey, Bush's economic advisor, suggested that this war might cost $200 billion. That was his high level. He was promptly fired and silenced. The $200 billion figure looks like the minimum we're going to spend. General Shinseki suggested we would need several hundred thousand troops to occupy Iraq. He was ridiculed. He could not be more wrong, was Rumsfeld's answer, sidelined and sort of pushed into early retirement. 200,000 troops is looking pretty much on the mark. The State Department spent a year and $5 million putting together plans for an occupation of Iraq. We weren't going to be occupying Iraq. Remember, this was a war that was going to prove Rumsfeld's vision of a new revolutionized military. It would be lighter and faster and smaller. We would get rid of that Powell Doctrine once and for all. Remember the triumphalism after Baghdad fell about how we had proven Rumsfeld right? Well, the problem was the State Department, General Shinseki, and everyone else who was an expert in the region said, no, obviously when we spend more than the next 20 countries combined on our military, we can pretty much rout anyone. The problem is you've got a country that has most of its population in urban centers that's deeply divided. These are, I think, George H.W. Bush's words. You would become an occupier with tremendous feuds coming over, and that's where you would need the hundreds of thousands of troops. This morning, that got underlined for us again. I remain an optimist on Iraq. I believe that we can turn things around and make it a better place, but often the daily news sort of smacks you in the face. The New York Times reports this morning that it has come out that during our occupation control of Iraq, before we handed over power, 350 tons of high-grade military explosives were looted. The problem is this was one of the sites the CIA had identified that we needed to guard, but we didn't have enough troops to guard all those places. We only had enough troops to guard the oil industry, actually. Now, that 350 tons wouldn't be so bad if people hadn't told us about it ahead of time, but that was under IAEA seal before the war. Several of the atomic inspectors warned us repeatedly we need to watch out for this cache. Let me put it in perspective. I'm living up in Scotland. The Lockerbie tragedy still hits home up there. It took 1 pound of this stuff to blow up the plane over Lockerbie. We allowed 350 tons to be looted because we did not have enough troops to protect a place the international inspectors warned us about and the CIA marked before the war. I think that was a mistake. The next time Bush is in a debate, I think he could list that. The problem, though, is that this administration doesn't want to ever admit accountability. Now, sometimes, I understand, Michael and I are going to trade barbs. Politics is dirty and not pretty. But there's a bigger problem than the November 2nd election. There is a battle for hearts and minds. Abu Ghraib was horrible. I do not think it represents anything about Americans or about American soldiers or about the many people who are serving very well over there. I do think it had problems to do when you start setting the Geneva Convention aside and bringing people over from Guantanamo and sending messages that say, as one of the Pentagon email reports said, take the gloves off, especially when the Pentagon reports indicate that 70% of the people at Abu Ghraib probably were innocent that were there. But the problem isn't that things happen. Problems happen in war. It's one of the good things about Rumsfeld and Cheney. Sometimes they're blunt. Sometimes bombs miss. War is dirty. It's something we should only go into when we are willing to take those risks. But the problem is you've got to hold people accountable. Sometimes we dislike Al Jazeera for what it publishes and for what Al Jazeera says. We think that they're giving a slanted perspective. But how can we get mad at Al Jazeera for showing those pictures, especially when a Republican senator said the pictures that came out were nothing compared to the pictures that didn't? How can we get mad at Al Jazeera when they talk about Rumsfeld signing off on the use of dogs or sending interrogators from Guantanamo to teach people how to interrogate in Iraq? Those things do not win the battle for hearts and minds. even if Rumsfeld was not directly responsible, he let that report sit on his desk for months. He didn't answer the Red Cross complaints that they started saying there are problems happening to people here. Cheney's response to all this was, get off his back. He's the best defense secretary we've ever had. What message does that send to Al Jazeera? No, what we needed to do was what Senator Kerry called for at the time, hold him responsible to prove to the Iraqi people that we are there for their good. Senator Kerry's approach to Iraq would be different. He's talked about internationalizing the force to take some pressure off U.S. troops, but more importantly, to help with the international image of what's happening, speeding up training, speeding up reconstruction, and really helping the Iraqis to set up a viable democracy and diplomacy. Now, I think most of this falls under a change in diplomacy, and it's that change in diplomacy we so need. We need more troops there, we need more training, but we need people to give us the benefit of the doubt. There's no way that President Bush gets a fresh start. Only electing a President Kerry would give us a fresh start. Indeed, only electing a President Kerry who would admit mistakes would give us a situation, would change the situation and give us a chance to win the battle of diplomacy. There are a number of other things that I'm sure will come up in questions. I would personally like to talk for a long time about the differences in the war on terrorism. Don't like the term to begin with because I think it's a tactic, but that's where our political landscape leaves us. But I think that there's a difference between the two candidates when it comes to that. One talks about how they attack us because they hate our freedoms. The other talks in depth about international jihadist movements and different organizations which crossbreed but have different localized problems. One president believes that the way to solve problems in the Middle East is to establish an Iraqi democracy. Once we have an Iraqi democracy, it will spread to other countries. That will help us solve, for example, problems in the Middle East between Israel and Palestine. The other candidate argues to be a president that says, yes, we need to establish an Iraqi democracy, but we can't wait for these other problems to solve. We can't wait to win the battles of hearts and minds after people see that democracy can take root in Iraq. It might take us 10 years, 5 years, 20 years to have a functioning democracy in Iraq based on other places. Can we let the Israeli-Palestinian problem continue to go without serious personal direct involvement from the United States for that 5, 10, 15, 20 years and not expect terrorism to get worse? I think that there are lots of choices that this presidency should be held accountable for. George Bush does not like to admit mistakes. Senator Kerry, I think, offers a different world vision. Let me talk about, in the final minute, two things that I think are very tough for the Democrats to answer. And that's how we would deal with treaties like Kyoto and the ICC and the Middle East peace process. Because to be honest with you, there is very little difference between Senator Kerry and President Bush's support for Israel. But there is a huge difference in their approach to how to solve the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Likewise, it is true, as I'm sure Michael will like to point out, that as written, the Senate would not have ratified Kyoto, nor would it have ratified the International Criminal Court. But the difference in both cases is that President Bush took a lesson and said, ah, these are difficult. Bill Clinton gave his heart and soul to the Middle East, and he didn't solve it and bring a peace. And so he walked away and stayed away from it. When it came to Kyoto, despite the rhetoric, you should really go back and look at the 2000 debates where President Bush went after Al Gore to say that he would be stronger, that is, Bush would be stronger on CO2. And then take a look at the announcement that says, oh, I didn't realize that CO2 wasn't a pollutant under our laws. We need more study on it. The United States, as the Republicans like to point out, leads the world in money spent on studying global warming to see whether or not it's a problem or not. The difference is President Kerry would seriously engage in these issues, and that is a huge difference. He would engage in the negotiations to find a better Kyoto alternative. He would engage to improve the ICC so it could be ratified by the Senate. He would seriously and personally engage in the Middle East to help bring a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And that's the difference we need. We need a president who really will live up to his campaign promises of making us stronger at home and respect in the world. And that president would be John Kerry.
And now we move on speedily to Michael Scott Carter to represent the Republicans. Michael, over to you.
Yes, thank you very much. I'd like to say thank you to everyone who's come out tonight. I know it can be a bit difficult at study time to come out and then listen to people kind of dribble on about, maybe in a rabbit fashion, about various things that may not be interesting or may be interesting. How many actually are here American, just so we can know? Okay, quite a few. Have you? Pardon me? Okay, I'm sorry about that. Normally, by the depth of my voice, it works out pretty well. I guess not today. Try. Is this better or worse? You got to forgive me. I was at a dinner party a couple days ago, and alcohol tends to cause me to have problems with my voice, actually. I don't get any other reaction but that. And so you have to forgive me. So if you can't hear me, I'm trying. But nevertheless, once again, I'd like to thank you for coming out. But what I was going to say is I hope you actually handed in your absentee ballots for those of you who are students here who are American. And how many are non-American here? Just to buy a show of hands? Okay, action. Yes.
You can't vote.
No, you can't. Well, if you go to where I'm from, there's a possibility. But no worries. I'd also like to say that I'm just trying to get the demographics down to more or less tailor what I'm going to say to you, to the people here, because most of you can't vote. Most of you have put your ballots in, so I could stand here and try and explain to you why President Bush is so much better than Kerry, as he did and allow us to sit through for the last 20 minutes. Nevertheless, I won't do that because I'd like to give you a better, kind of wider view of Iraq, the Kyoto Treaty, and also the ICC. Because how many actually know about what the Kyoto Treaty is truly about? Just by a show of hands. Oh, that's pretty good. Well, I see. Oh, by the way, I've considered. I have considered LSE to do a PhD here. I called and they haven't returned my call yet, so I'm a bit disappointed actually. Please do, Michael Carter, that is. And how many are familiar with the ins and outs of the ICC? Just good. And you guys truly know about this. All right, fine, if you say so. Nevertheless, we'll go. I'll just talk to you a bit about that, give you an alternative opinion, because I'm not here to try and convince you to vote for George W. or Kerry, as it's too late for that. Hopefully it's been done, and what we'll do is just kind of focus on an in-depth view of Iraq, the Kyoto Treaty, and also the ICC, because I'm sure I can give you an alternative opinion, and hopefully it'll make you think about republicanism in the future. I'm going to give you three quotes that you'll find very interesting. These are all taken from the Foreign Office. We have made an immense failure here. The system must have been far more at fault than anyone suspected. It would have had to be fundamentally changed. I suppose we have underestimated the fact that this country is really an inchoate mass of tribes which can't as yet be reduced to any system. I think we're on the edge of a pretty considerable Arab nationalist demonstration, with which I'm a good deal in sympathy. And the third is from a statement to Parliament by the Prime Minister. We might abandon the country altogether, but what would happen if we withdrew after enormous expenditure which we have incurred in freeing the country from withering despotism, to hand it back to anarchy and confusion, and to make no responsibility for its development would be an act of folly and quite indefensible. All three statements were taken from 1920, after Britain had liberated Mesopotamia from 600 years of Turkish rule. The situation then was, if anything, rather worse than now, as Gertrude Bell describes. The highest Shiite authorities were using the pulpits to stir up a jihad. In the past, Sunnis had looked askance at such preachings of holy war, worried that they would lead an Islamic state. But for the first time in anyone's memory, Sunni township and Shiite tribesmen set aside their bitter prejudice and joined together against a common enemy. The British, the underlying motive, is out with the infidel. The Shamar sheikhs urged the killings of Englishmen and near Mosul. Six were murdered. The High Commissioner ordered the area to be machine gun, insurgents imprisoned, and elitists deported. The residents of the town were all turned out of their houses and every house destroyed. Nor would the British allow the town to be rebuilt. It was punished. It was punishment Wilson would use again and again. In spite of the absence, what today would be called a hearts and minds campaign, the 40-year period of British administration overwatched at least the administration is recalled as a success. And we achieve it with the imposition of a pro-Western leader. The idea of a king, incidentally, as a result of Arab, the idea of a king came, incidentally, as a result of the Arabic advice. You British wish to build the government of Iraq in a usual, solid English fashion. You want to begin with the foundations and then follow with the walls, the roof, and then the decorations. This is not my idea of what the way would to be built Iraq. No. Begin with the roof, supported by the few pillars. The roof will encourage us to continue. Otherwise, the slowness of building may discourage us. Give us a king, and he will be our roof, and we will work downwards. Iraqis do not lack in wisdom, but they do not yet have the ability to rid themselves of vestiges of Saddam's rule. This is what we principally in American Britain are determined to give, in spite of the moral sapping effect of the Western press. Listen to the description of Baghdad. The citadel of the Tigris, built by the Abbasid Caliph Mansur 8 centuries after the birth of Christ and 1 century after the death of Prophet Muhammad, flourished for 500 years. The heart of the Abbasid Empire is what the largest, most prosperous city in the world. More than 1 million people of every imaginable race, color and creed filed into the narrow streets, worked in the shops, bathed in the bathhouses, and gossiped in the coffee houses. Sophisticated and cosmopolitan, the Baghdad of 1,000 years ago boasted bookstores and literary salons, banks and commercial houses, gardens and zoos. Its writers and poets produced some of the Arabic's world's greatest literature and transformed into Arabic the works of Plato and Aristotle. Its mathematicians calculated Arabic numbers, introduced the concepts of zeros. The scientists built astronomical observatories, studied the round surface of the earth. Its physicians earned their degrees. And we can go on and on. Would it be wonderful to hand back this type of Iraq back to the Iraqis? A prospect such as this is amazing. And why not? They are educated, secular by inclination, blessed with fertile land, irrigated by 2 mighty rivers and the world's 2nd largest oil reserves. What were the Iraqis' prospects before our invasion? Why more of the same? Saddam might have been assassinated. Certainly, he feared this. But his succession was assured to be in the form of Uday Qusay. Both psychopaths feared almost as much as Saddam himself. Had we not removed Saddam by now, and I speculate the pressure to lift UN sanctions would surely have been overwhelmed. And within a few years, Saddam probably would have acquired nuclear weapons. He already had bunkers to survive retaliation. And we know he had weapons programs as the CPA continued to pay for his 70,000 military scientists to prevent them from sharing their considerable expertise with other like-minded despots. So what is going on in Iraq? Why can't we carry the mass of the people with us? Well, of course, the mass of people are with us, but silent majorities are good news and not what the press care to report on. Only if we could feed the media as efficiently as Zarqawi, the devil who held Mr. Bigley, and others, maybe we could tap into the Middle East talents. Saatchi and Saatchi came from Baghdad, after all. Thank God the IRA failed to exploit the media half as so successfully. Could we ever have won a war which was reduced to daily sufferings of individuals? Fortunately, such media assaults have almost no effect on our troops, and none that I can detect on American forces who are anyway too well-disciplined to betray any self-doubt. A quote from an infrastructure security official states this: "The situation in Iraq is not so much better or worse than the press portrays, just different. It must be hard to provide for 24 hours news coverage. Security managers so restrict the movement of reporters. There's only so much that one can see from a roof of the Sheraton Hotel in Baghdad. Surely one cannot see Fallujah 40 miles away, and let alone Mosul 200 miles distant." This is an extract from the same official in Iraq. I'm going to give you a tour of Iraq through his eyes. Saddam's transport of first choice, incidentally, was a taxi. We shall start the journey in North Iraq, Kurdistan, where Saddam never went. The landscape is very beautiful with snow-capped mountains on the Turkish and Iranian borders. This guy has stayed in who I'm quoting, stayed in hotels in Erbil and also other places, feeling as if on holiday, for which purpose these hotels are built. The people are strong and distinctive in their appearance, many wearing baggy trousers and cummerbunds. Walking through the crowded squares, you would be instantly recognized as British or American and warmly welcomed on the strength of it. Christians and Muslims live in harmoniously among one another. Mosul and Kirkuk, both rich from oil, lie on the border between Kurd and Arab. Each could and almost certainly would be descended into bloodshed if the American troops' presence were completely removed. Both had large influxes of Southerners forced up from the Saddam, and the endorsed program to return houses to their rightful owners would cause friction for years to come. Best to be in an Arab-driven taxi for the next stage of our tour journey south to the route one took to Crete. The Sunni heartland, some of Saddam. Prosperous and middle class, it has rich farmland and some splendid outbuildings. But most of it all is dominated by Saddam's pompous palaces. With the oil for food, UN sanctions program, Saddam built 30 palaces and villas within the areas that the size of Windsor Great Park, from which his people were excluded, of course. There is no evidence that he lived in any of these monstrosities. His movement with his creation of a dynasty, the holy sites, his development as mere tourist attractions, all evidence of popular monarchist period he removed, leaving only Saddam invincible. For the present and future generations to admire, the systematic corruption of the oil industry, the tribe and other mullahs and the state itself left a void which the CPA was to coy to fill with the MacArthur-style governor general, Iraqi people crave for a strong leadership. The mechanism by which Saddam achieved absolute control was by the Ba'athist Party, modeled almost precisely on the Nazi Party, reaching into every family. So it's unsurprising that to Crete there are well-funded cells which oppose Prime Minister Alawi, new Iraqi government. I tend to agree with Ambassador Bremer, the army wasn't worth saving with his 11,000 generals. But we were perhaps rash not to have kept the Secret Service, which might now be working for us rather than against us. We might even have convinced the Sunni, the minority, that we, the coalition, were their only friends. But all is not lost. Local administration is taking hold. When I first met the governor of the province, I complimented him on English. While it wasn't characteristic of his native language, he explained that he had been for 35 years a dentist in Manchester. He returned to Iraq after he overthrew Saddam to retire at his birthplace. Nothing, a capable man in their midst, the local period elected him for governor. Incidentally, be in no doubt that democracy is what the Iraqis want, and no one after his arrest wants Saddam, that's for sure. The next stage of our journey is westward, and here's the problem. Fallujah have been truculent communities for as long as anyone can remember. Tribal and essentially lawless, there is a lingering affection for the British dating back to Lawrence of Arabia's success in stirring the people to rebel against the Turks in 1916. It was army officers from Ramadi who murdered the royal family in 1958. In 1964, a rebellion and Fallujah was put down by systematic killing of every citizen until they gave up. When Prime Minister Alawi visited the city last month, he berated the leaders by calling them whores and cowards who had disgraced the city. Strong stuff. The fact is that we have lost control of Fallujah, and it has become a haven for foreign fighters and Saddam loyalists who now sport long beards and have fallen prey to seductive simplicity of Muslim fundamentalists. It is a dangerous place, which we have to be won over with a degree of ruthlessness and without the interference of the press. The operation in April was a disaster, but no blame attaches to the U.S. Marines, who were magnificent. It was a classic case of ill-judged political interference, which sent the Marines in before they were ready and pulled them out before the job was done. The Syrian border must have been effectively policed and pressure bought on the President Bashir to withdraw from the mercenaries. With a narrow focus on the Western media, it is all too easy to forget that the whole point of the enterprise is to embed a democracy as an example to neighboring Syria, Iran, and Saudi Arabia, a concept their leaders seem to fear. Before leaving the West, or Anbar, Providence, as it is known, let me recount an anecdote. In January, we were lunching the governor of Ramadi, and I'm still quoting from this guy, who was also a powerful old Shiite. Sitting cross-legged around the walls of the large guest house by the State Department colleagues, Hugh Gegen's mobile telephone rang. They raised his hand, ordering silence, adding the further to Hugh's discomfort. When the call at the end, Mr. Hugh, who had the news for us, he said, "Yes," he replied, "Saddam Hussein has been arrested." "Yes," he replied, "Saddam Hussein has been arrested in Tikrit." And the fight, and like a lion that they thought would be incurred, was not there. End of the lunch party, everyone left, and that was it. So now to the south, the holy cities and the marshlands in which Wilford Tressert lived for many years, home of the Shia. It is true that Sadar appeals to young and unemployed in a region which Saddam neglected. But the reconstruction is no doubt a strong promise for those there. Traditionally, lawless foreign officers ruled in the 1930s required travel in a minimum of 2 cars with police escort. The British and the Polish areas are of responsibility cry out for more troops until indigenous security forces are ready to take over. The Americans have virtually replaced the Poles in these areas because European rules of engagement preclude offensive operations. I'm not an expert on the rules, but I am suspicious of them when one reads of young soldiers on trial. Presumably, they were acting in good faith at the least. The United States was prudent in not rushing into European-style Court of Human Rights, which might be applied to combat operations, and pragmatic in putting some distance between herself and new international courts. Democracy in southern Iraq has a sporting chance, and a robust economy is virtually dead cert to give the prodigious quantity of oil and gas which lie just below the surface. The Grand Ayatollah Sistani, recovering well from his heart operation in London, is clearly a man of great influence who can tip the balance one way or the other. If only he could be persuaded to condemn absolutely the ghastly Muqtada al-Sadr. The risk in the South is not so much Sadr himself, although the support he gets from Iran is troubling. It is the lawlessness which he spawns and the opportunity that provides for real terrorists. And finally, to Baghdad, a city of 5 million souls, which over half live in the slum previously called Saddam City. It is a pale reflection of the citadel of the Tigris I described earlier, but it has excellent universities and an infrastructure which is repairable at least. 10 months ago when I arrived, it was possible to dine in smarter restaurants, and this is when I was actually visiting there. Bombing and kidnapping have driven all who can afford into hotels and international zones away. We are engaged in a race. The coalition is building up a competent police force, a national guard with insurgents that are trying their best to create a structure that prevents anarchy, which is first to hold elections that might prove possible. It will be a close-run race. The stakes are very high indeed. In a year's time, we can have a fledgling democracy, a well-funded reconstruction program underway, and a growing economy, possibly. Or we could have an anarchy out of which might emerge another extremist regime. In arguing the case for sticking with it, Mr. Blair need only quote the words of Lloyd George. To hand Iraq back to anarchy and confusion would be an act of folly and quite indefensible. So this is just kind of a bird's eye view into what's happened in Iraq. This is just to give you an idea that's what's happening on the ground, and so you can have a better view of what the media is giving you. I'm not saying it's the same, but it's just a different view, more or less. The one thing I like to focus on is also foreign policy, outside of Iraq, that is. because the issue with Iraq is quite contentious, as Jamie touched on. But the funny thing about foreign policy is that you can't really win with it, because part of what happens, we're in two structures. We're in two structures of foreign policy. We have what we do as individuals, and we have what we want the government to do. What we do as individuals has a lot to do with how the government react. Prime example, by us not knowing how to coordinate, we inevitably cause a lot of polluting to happen, because pollution is just the inability to coordinate, essentially. Because if we all could take out our garbage at the same time and turn off our televisions from the hold mode that allows it to stay on and various things like this, then we'd have less of a problem. But I'd like to focus on a few things that are a bit more possibly interesting. President Bush's goals of sustaining democratic peace and disseminating American core values resonate with those most traditional themes in U.S. history. They harken back to the puritanical rhetoric of city upon a hill. They rekindle of Thomas Jefferson's vision of the empire of liberty. They were integral in Woodrow Wilson's missive that the world must be made safe for democracy. They follow Franklin Roosevelt's four freedoms. They echo the normal rhetoric of John F. Kennedy's inaugural address to pose any foe to assure a survival and success of liberty. Nor is unilateralism new. From America's inception, as in a republic, the founding fathers foresaw entangling alliances that might embroil the fragile country in dangerous old world controversies and tarnish the United States' identity as an extremist nation. Actually, unilaterally, the United States could prudently pursue its own interests, nurture its fundamental ideas, and define itself as an opposition in the Europeans' forebears. The tradition is the one in which Bush returns. Critics argue that Bush's revolutionary foreign policy repudiates the multilateralism that flowered after the Second World War and served the United States so well during the Cold War. The critics have a point, albeit one that should not be exaggerated. The wise men of the Cold War embraced collective security, forged NATO, created a host of other multilateral institutions, and grasped the interdependence of the modern global economy. Nonetheless, they never repudiate the right to act alone. Although they reserved the option to move unilaterally, they did not declare it as a doctrine. Precisely the opposite. Publicly, they affirmed the U.S. commitment to collective security and multilateralism. Privately, they acknowledged the United States might have to act unilaterally, and it more or less did in the same in Vietnam and elsewhere and in the Third World. The difference between Bush and his predecessors have to do mainly with style, as we all know. Substance more to do with balance between competing strategies than goals, with the exercise of good judgment than with definition of worldview. The perception of great threat and possession of unprecedented power have tipped the balance toward unilateralism, but there is nothing revolutionary in Bush's goal of vision. The U.S. quest for international order based on freedom, self-determination, and open markets have changed astonishingly. Now, that's just a good idea of how we're looking at what's happening with the foreign policy, particularly with leaders who were before President Bush. One of the other things I'd like to just briefly talk about before we go into the question and answer is the Kyoto Treaty. Now, there are numerous problems with it. One, it's the simple fact that what was being asked is that countries were to sign up to a treaty that would allow the emissions we lowered. We needed something close to, I think it was 55 countries to sign up for it to actually be enacted. But the problem with Kyoto, the reason why President Bush did not keep up with it, even though it was signed on the last day of President Clinton going out of office, and I'm sure he was aware that it wouldn't be ratified in the next administration, was that it was too inconclusive. One of the simple facts was that you're asking for the major countries in the G7 to sign up to this, lower their emissions within a certain amount of time, and the other countries that are not a part of it would get a longer time to combat this problem. Now, this affects the economy in two ways. One, it causes another economy to have to straighten up in 5 or 6 more years before one. And the other, to have to just immediately plunge a lot of resources in making this thing happen quickly. The only problem is this would affect global economy in a way I think all of us are not ready for. I'm in favor of a form of a ratification in the Kyoto Treaty, but I'm not in favor of signing up for it as it is right now, as Jamie explained to you, Senator John Kerry isn't as well. So I think there's a lot of work to be done on the level of democracy and also helping individuals in particular situations that are difficult for all of us. Because we can go back and forth for the whole night and say John Kerry is this and President Bush is that. But on the home front, we all need to take progressive action in doing what we can to make sure things work out. Because this election season is sewed up. We'll all find out who will win next week. But on the face of it, we need to pretty much analyze what's happening on the world scale and make sure we have a good idea of what's going on with these, in particular the Kyoto Treaty, and particularly with China, also South Korea, and Iran, to make sure that we can actually do a lot, opposed to just focusing on two leaders who really can't do much without our help. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Martin. Okay, let's thank you very much, Michael. I think we should move into Q&A as quickly as possible. First question, please. You don't have to declare your nationality or who you're going to vote for. I don't really mind. Over here, please. There's two here. One there.
Hi, my name is Stacey. I'm a second-year IR student. This question is for Mr. Carter. You seem to emphasize what you consider a negative representation that the media had about the situation in Iraq, whether it be televised or otherwise. You didn't specify whether that was U.S. media or the international community. Because if it's about the U.S., I want to know whether you think whether the reporting of, say, the Fox network isn't sufficiently fair and balanced as regards the situation in Iraq.
Yes, Fox network, it's...
Do you want to take a couple of questions? There's another question in front of you? Yeah, guy here in black. Sorry, Mark, just want to...
Yeah, Hal Godfrey, first year history and international relations. For Jamie Dumas, how can you possibly say that John Kerry is going to take further role with regards to the Israel-Palestine crisis when he continues to condone Israel's disgraceful theft of Palestinian territory and the war, which is basically going to make a two-state solution completely impossible?
Okay. Right. Are there any others down here at the moment? Okay, one behind, obscured by the man with the microphone in his hand. Yeah, thank you.
Hi. Excuse me. Is it working?
Yeah, please. Yeah, speak up.
Hi, I'm Marta Skantrick. I'm a second-year IR student as well. I'd like to ask both...
nice one.
Speakers as to how they would improve the ICC. Because I don't think either of them spoke sufficiently about that, especially not the Mr. Carter. Right, thank you.
Right. Right, we've got one on Fox, we've got one on something else, and one on ICC. Do you want to take Fox?
Yeah, sure, I'll take that.
Right, good. He's Australian, you know. So.
Yeah, Rupert Murdoch, guys. The issue with Fox, I think... If you look at what's happening with CNN and BBC here, it's a completely different picture that's happening in the U.S. For example, a friend of mine yesterday was on a Jonathan Dimbleby show, and they focused entirely on what was the movement of these 600 troops, and how is that? That must have been a political decision, because definitely President Bush was trying to ensure some form of votes within 2 weeks of the election period that would definitely allow something to happen out of there. And there was no real news coverage in the States about 600 troops being moved to one place to another. Because although not to minimize it, it's only 600 troops who were being moved to secure something for election bay. So they focused on that for 3 or 4 days. And the news media, if you were watching Fox, really just said there were just 600 troops being moved to a different location. And another problem I have is it's amazing how they want to cover every movement that happens within security. And pretty much give anyone who's trying to go after the military force on the ground a chance to react to their every movement. So we know they're going to Fallujah and the various other places. It's great for security and also protecting those soldiers who are on the ground who we're not hoping to be killed. But on that, I just think there's just kind of a huge focus on the insignificant if you compare it to what's happening with American news media, because it's not as politicized as they try and make some of the events here. And on the issue of, did you want me to take the...
Yep.
What was the other guy's question?
About Israel. Second question was about Israel. That's you. You're Israel.
Yes.
What about Fox?
I thought I covered that, but nevertheless I didn't. It's still fair and balanced, and they didn't really...
I detect some skepticism in the audience there, Michael. No, I can't believe it.
Well, I didn't comment on 60 Minutes and how... if that's fair, you just call me imbalanced. And But I think... I just think it's one of those things that as you focus on the issue with the movement, as I focus on the issue of movements of troops, I think it's a great balance within the media if we look at the other side that is just a constant pervasive attack of kind of very different ideology, I'd call it, or left, which is another good word. But I think so. A friend of mine is actually doing a PhD here, and he's focusing on how he's cataloging to see what stations are actually more left-leaning or right-leaning. And when he publishes his findings, it'll be fairly interesting to see what he's come up with. He's already telling me that largely a lot of the media outlets are very left-leaning. He's Italian, so he's not American, so you don't have to worry about any real sort of bias there.
Yeah, right, good. Well, Israel. Why hasn't Kerry said anything about Israel? I think that was the brunt of the question there. Jamie?
I'd rather talk about Fox having fair and balanced trademarked, if you'd let me.
No, actually.
He's answered that question. We want Israel.
I'm going to steal an answer from someone else that was given another night, because I think we could probably go to a pub and debate for a long time about the best way to come to a peace agreement in Israel based upon starting positions. And the answer goes something like this, and it rings true for the people that I work with. My British and European friends have one starting perspective on the Middle East peace problem. Many Americans have a different starting perspective. The American perspective is far more sympathetic to Israel. The European and British perspective is far more sympathetic to the Palestinians. And you can watch it in the coverage, the assumptions about was there a massacre in Jenin or what happens after a suicide bombing. My perspective is that is certainly true, but I don't think we're going to change those two starting points. What I think we have for a unique truth right now is that the European and American perspectives and the British come much closer about what we see as being a reasonable end point. And that is that we need to have a viable, autonomous Palestinian state that can control its own functioning and will really be allowed to run a government. Now, we can argue for a long time, and I think that there are probably a lot more people than in here have been arguing for a long time about what exact compromises can be gotten out of the Palestinians or the Israelis, you know, what little deals could be cut, over exactly how the borders would be drawn. I think that if your starting perspective is you can only get peace if you tell Israel that Israel is totally to blame, that it must go back to the 1948, the 1967, or whatever borders, I think you're guaranteed to fail, just as you are guaranteed to fail if you back everything Sharon says unquestionably. I think the difference is, I also think, though, that you're guaranteed to fail if the United States does not put its full effort into it. If the United States only continues to fully support Israel, which is what I think we've done for the last 4 years, it's going to continue to be a problem. If the United States, even if you convince me over the pint later, but you have to buy the pint, that the United States is biased, if the United States brings back the commitment that President Clinton brought to the Middle East, we might not end up with a perfect solution. We can have a Rawlsian philosophical debate about whether or not the solution would be a good one, but I think we're far more likely to end up with a real solution in a much shorter time frame. That's why I think Senator Kerry would be better.
I think there's one other question
ICC?
About
the... It was on the ICC.
Oh, did you want me to say something?
You can both say something quickly on the ICC, yeah. Michael, do you want to say something on that?
On the last day of President Clinton's day in office, he signed the treaty on the criminal court. The only thing I can say to that is I think he was very much aware that it wasn't going to be ratified. With the International Criminal Court, we can go into some very pragmatic things about why it wouldn't work. For example, I was in the military. And the issue that I have is if we look at what happened in the Second World War about us bombing places that were deemed to be have civilians there, then technically we would be accused of committing crimes under the ICC convention. But the issue is that war is a very difficult thing to try and categorize and catalog and say which is the better way to go and which isn't. Now, being in the military, it's very difficult at times to just say the court would be a good thing. And also, then what would that do with the Security Council position? Because they're supposed to be there to make sure that peace and democracy and war is conducted properly. So the issue there is, would they be negated at that point? Or how would these two kind of work autonomously according to the convention they're supposed to be able to? So I just find some structural issues with it, being wrong with it. And also for the simple fact that President Clinton decided to sign it on his last day to just kind of force the Bush administration to deal with it is very typical of this type of politics. But nevertheless.
Jamie, do you want to take a different squeeze on that one, on sure. The ICC?
I think our calendars have different last days in them. But that's not the important issue. It was Clinton did sign it, or the Clinton administration signed it, knowing that it would not pass the Senate. I think the difference is too many Americans seem to believe that the ICC was created to try American troops in kangaroo courts, whereas a lot of us think that the ICC was created to deal, so we could have a standing body to deal with problems like Milosevic and Rwanda and other situations where we end up in ad hoc situations trying to create international law. I think that this is one of those situations where a non-zero-sum approach is better. We need to convince too many Americans that it's not going to be used and abused against them. And maybe that meant some either cosmetic changes or some serious legal changes. I'm not finishing a law degree. To make sure that the guarantees that are already there, such as if the country involved actually opens investigations and prosecutions, then the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction, which seems to get rid of most of them in my mind. But even if it's just cosmetic changes to it, we needed some changes that would have allowed the American Senate to pass it. And there are lots of senators on both sides of the aisle who support legislation like this. It's just that it needs to be done in a way that Americans would be comfortable with.
Yeah, I just want to go to the top here. There's a couple of questions up, two or three up there. If you can be brief and to the point, please.
Yes, Dr. Shara Ali, Green Party parliamentary candidate. I'd like concise personal opinions, please, from both the speakers on the following propositions as adjudicated by the World Court, which I think is a good starting point. An unassailable one on the perspective of the Israel-Palestine conflict. Number one, the wall in the Palestine territories is contrary to international law. Number two, the wall should be dismantled immediately. And number three, the Palestinians deserve reparations.
Very much. Succinct to the point. The gentleman there. Gentleman here, please.
Jonathan Hoffman. I did my master's degree here 20 years ago. I'm now an economist in the city. I'd like to know how either candidate can claim to have a sensible energy policy when gasoline is so underpriced compared with Europe, and the price fails to completely reflect the social cost of using up the depletable resource. While gasoline is so cheap, it cannot possibly be a sensible energy policy.
My name is Hilal Chalabi. I come from Iraq. I want to ask the Democrat, what is the position of John Kerry about the? Are they going? Is the American policy after him will continue to support the march toward democracy? Most of Iraqi people, the majority of them, supported the overthrow of the tyrannical regime of Saddam Hussein. It is okay for people living in a free society in the West, but we have 1 million people. The regime of Saddam Hussein calls us. In Abu Ghraib, this notorious now they talk, but it was notorious at that time. One political prisoner, who was actually a member of the Ba'ath Party, they brought his wife, they raped her, and they killed her in front of him. That is the regime which been toppled by the American and the British, and we are very grateful for that. It's okay for people living in a free society to talk about. When the Minister of Health, the Ba'athist Minister of Health, asked me, Saddam to resign it temporarily in order to stop the war with Iran. He was attacked by Saddam and his bodyguard, and they killed him and sent his body to his wife. So therefore, I think this is the illegality. Genocide is illegal. So what he would say, the most important is to support the democracy in Iraq. We have got a freedom of press. We have got freedom of political party. And the ironical thing is that the left in Iraq benefit. Under Saddam, we had Minister of Communist Minister of Culture is a Communist Party member. We have a deputy minister. So can you what we said? Is the John Kerry policy to support the march democracy, toward democracy in Iraq or not?
Thank you very much. I will take a couple down here quickly because there's a couple of hands up here. Yeah, one, two.
I'm Rachel Coffey. I work in UK central government. I want to know what Bush and Kerry would have to say about, sorry, what they would have to do about deepening poverty and inequality in the developing world.
Okay, and
then. Kathy Hall, and I work with Rachel. I wanted to come back to Michael on his points about the troops and the coverage of them. First of all, I don't think you compare Fox to UK coverage since the UK troops. And I wanted to know why, if they're so insignificant, it really matters that they have to come from the UK and not from America. If they're so insignificant, why can't you spare 600 troops?
Okay, I'll take one more. I'll take the final one there. Chap in red, please.
Yeah, for me, the most devastating thing about Kerry's record is not the fact that he's voted for this or that, but the fact that in 20 years in the Senate, he hasn't had a sort of major piece of legislation to his name. So what do you say to the charge that Kerry wasn't exactly the Democrats' first choice for president and that he hasn't got much of a moral center, as that's the criticism? What do you think?
All right, I think that's a relatively balanced set of questions. Right, who wants to start? Israel-Palestine wall, which question started up there.
Do you want to alternate back and forth the questions?
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll see.
For the World Court's ruling, I'd have to take the official American position. It was only an advisory ruling from the World Court, but honestly, for a personal opinion, it's the same thing I said before. Whether or not Kerry and you will disagree on that, I think the difference between Kerry and Bush is one of serious engagement. And we can quibble about those for a long time, but if we ignore it, we don't solve the problem.
Okay. So we're going to move over to the question of energy.
Okay. The cheapening of gas in the U.S. Well, under the Clinton administration, we had a chance to actually have more fuel to have cars have better gas mileage, but he didn't sign it into force. The only thing I can say is I can agree with you if we look at energy policy that there is a difficulty with gasoline being so very cheap in the U.S. and saying that, but it's not also the U.S. There are other countries, for example, Australia and other places that have not passed in the buck, but for the simple fact that it is something we'd have to considerably look at because with what is alleged to be happening with the greenhouse effect, is something that we definitely have to take care of in the future. But it is also partly individual in nature.
There was a question from the gentleman. Do you want to pick that one up?
Yeah, on the energy policy. I don't think Clinton ever vetoed a CAFE fuel standard increase rise. Kerry is pushing for a 50% increase in the CAFE standards and is pushing for us to put the efforts that we put into putting a person on the moon into developing alternative energy. It may not be as much as the Green Party would like, but it's a lot more than we're going to get for 4 more years of Bush.
But he left anyway, so you have to worry.
There was a question from the gentleman back there about Kerry and Iraq democratization.
Kerry fully supports and has remained committed to staying in Iraq for a large number of reasons. One is that we cannot afford to fail, but another one is that, and what he likes to quote is, you know, Colin Powell's words, if you broke it, you fix it. And we're there, it would be much worse if we leave. We need to make sure that we win the peace in Iraq. I think Kerry is fully supportive of the idea of a movement towards democracy. The difference between Kerry and Bush on this is Bush seems to believe that it'll solve all of our problems once we have democracy. Kerry believes we need to work towards democracy and work on solving the other problems as well.
Okay, do you want to come back up? Or do you want to pick up the fourth question on poverty and inequality and what's going to be done? Or do you want to take up that point?
Well, yeah, I'll take a part of what Jamie was talking about. This is from the difference between a governor and a senator is one, the senator votes on everything for most of his time, and the governor actually takes control and does particular things. The issue with Kerry is I don't believe you'd ever have a strategic way of going into any type of war-torn situation to fix anything by virtue of just his military effectiveness record. Granted, they both have some fairly interesting military records, but I just think as a person, and what he has the ability to do and the way he has shown himself to be in the Senate, I don't think he'd have what it takes to actually go into these places and then take up the helm and fix them. Now, on the other question are we going to the
poverty?
Yeah, sure. You both pick up on poverty and inequality.
The deepening poverty and situation in the under-industrialized countries, it is fairly serious. But we're faced with a lot of geopolitical problems and just going after it kind of in this arena. It'd be too hard to debate, but I'd just like to make a couple points on it. One, that by virtue of just how economics work, it puts us in a very difficult situation because we're working in a market system that doesn't necessarily work for markets, that doesn't have the ability to stand strong. Also, if we look at the formulation of countries coming together, for example, the European Union, the 22-nation Arabic coalition, this is to strengthen certain markets that were previously weakened because of what's happening with world economy. So if we look at all this formation as coming together with all these various countries and alliances, then it will cause problems for industrialized countries who don't have the ability to protect themselves from protectionist economics. So the issue is that somehow we have to look at these structures and try and change them and integrate them to make it a bit more easier, which the Bush administration is trying to do with the South American trade agreement that is kind of similar to that of NAFTA. But that's all I have to say for that.
Okay, and one final one. I think Kerry doesn't have any major piece of legislation to his name.
I would spend that to say that just because Kerry has never been a grandstander that's put his name on a piece of legislation does not take anything away from a distinguished 20-year career where many different groups have supported him. He's passed a number of bills that he wrote and put forward. More importantly, he's been involved as a senator in some very strong things, the BCCI investigation. Going back to one of the things I mentioned before, going to Vietnam to deal with the POW-MIA issue for both Senator McCain and Senator Kerry was a vote loser. No constituency in the United States that was going to benefit wanted to put their neck forward on that. He showed the type of leadership to take his personal credibility and resolve a longstanding sore in our international relations. Likewise, I think you could look at his support in the ways contributed to environmental legislation. He wrote the first acid rain legislation. Doesn't fight to put his name on it, but has a long, distinguished record. People like Senator McCain, when attacks start on his military record or on his legislative record, step forward to say, don't attack it. He's been a good senator. He was a good military person. I think that the reality is, take a look at that long set of 6,000 votes, the things he's done over that period of time, and if you really seriously look at it, you'll find someone you could be proud of and inspired by.
I think the operative word that he started with was spin.
All right. You got the last word in there, Mike. Before I was asked to chair this meeting, I was handed a set of guidelines by somebody who said, guide to chairing public meetings in the event of disorder. And but I haven't had to use them at all, so you've been a very nice audience altogether.
I think we missed one question.
Oh, did we? No, I don't think so.
The insignificance of troop movement.
Do you want to pick that one up then quickly?
Yeah, okay. Just for the sake
sorry,
of... I didn't forget you.
Time. Sorry.
I wasn't in any way demeaning it. I was just simply saying that this particular movement, the Black Watch, they are historically known in the military to have specific expertise that is why they're there. So by virtue of them being moved opposed to anyone else is because they have a specific training that's specific to what's needed to be done and where they're being moved to. Being in the military and seeing what they can do, I can attest to that fact. So I'm not in any way demeaning it. I'm just simply saying it was 600 troops who were being moved, and it was not as significant as we tried to make it.
Yeah, okay. Thanks very much for that. Anyway, I'd like to thank you all tonight for not being disorderly. But more importantly, I'd like to thank Jamie and Michael for stimulating a debate. I won't ask for a vote, indicative or otherwise. There may be some Americans still left in the audience. But anyway, I'd like to thank the two speakers here this evening and to thank you all for this discussion. Thank you.